right, thanks. Right, so there are a couple things that will, I guess, make my talk a bit different than some of the ones you've heard so far. The first is, well, this seems to be a bit of a temple to the fly. We're now going to move to C. elegans, so the nematode, and I'll try to give you a little bit of introduction. I couldn't fit a complete C. elegans introduction and a talk on polarity into the same talk, so definitely introduce me if, interrupt me and ask questions if things were unclear about the system. And the second thing is, I think most of the seminars so far have talked a lot about morphogenesis really at the tissue scale. Right? And I think the important thing to remember is a lot of that is also representing processes happening at the level of the cell as well. And what I'm really going to talk about is pattern formation on a very different scale, and that's on the scale of a single cell, and what we like to call sort of a process of intracellular pattern formation. And essentially, this is ultimately the pattern that we're going to focus on today. And this is the model system that we work on. This is the C. elegans embryo. And essentially, what I want to convey to you sort of a little bit, the talk kind of has three parts. We'll see how far we get in the constraints of time. But initially, I'm going to generally give you an introduction to this to cell polarity, the system we work in, and sort of how we've started to think about how this kind of pattern can emerge. And this is primarily old data. And then just sort of two short stories that we've recently been doing in the lab since I moved from my postdoc in Dresden to the Francis Crick Institute about 3 years ago. And we'll see how far we get, and we can jettison one if we're running out of time. So definitely interrupt. I tried to build in different stopping points so that we all stay on track. So what do we mean by polarity? So, I mean, obviously the term doesn't originate in biology in those cells, and many of you will be familiar with the concept of polarity, namely the idea that you have essentially a vector with two poles with very opposite characteristics, sort of like a magnetic field, dipoles, for example, in water or electric field. But essentially, cell biologists have taken this concept and applied it to cells. So, for example, here's a very highly polarized, highly asymmetric cell. It's a neuron. You have a cell body with its associated dendrites, sort of for local communication, and then you have this long differentiated axon to communicate over long distances. So this very clearly has an extended polarized morphology. But in fact, what I'm going to try and stress in the first few slides is that cell polarity is incredibly universal in biology. So for example, we see it in migratory cells. So this is a mammalian cell, very clearly polarized along the axis of movement, but we also see polarity in things like bacteria. So this is Vibrio cholera. So it swims directionally and has a polar flagella that helps orient itself. As many of you have probably been aware of through this course, or perhaps otherwise, polarity also happens at the scale of tissues. And so, for example, in epithelia, you have very clear apical basal polarity, where you have a sort of a one end of the cell is highly specialized for interacting with the environment, and then this basal lateral surface simply contacts other cells. Right, and then you've also heard, I think, probably about planar cell polarity, where cells essentially are polarized sort of within a 2D plane, right? So here, from this is essentially proximal distal. I think this is an example of the wing. This is lung villi. So these are the cells lining the little villi inside your lungs. So this would be out, and this would be towards the body. And in fact, in many tissues, you can even see that cells are multiply polarized. So for example, in the wing, right? This is an epithelia. So these typically are apically basally polarized. Right, but then they're also planar polarized in the 2D plane. Right, so polarity can encompass all of this sort of diversity of processes and organizations of cells. And one thing I also want to stress is, so if you look sort of at the wing, this polarity is relatively set and evolves somewhat slowly over time. But in fact, in many cases, polarity is quite dynamically specified. So this is just three examples I pulled. This is the bacterium E. coli, fish and yeast, S. pombi, and the slime mold Dictyostelium, all of which are capable of defining their cell polarity. And they do so quite dynamically. So for example, in E. coli, you have this oscillating system that defines the cell poles. You see a somewhat similar system in Pombi using a completely different set of molecules. And here, Dictyostelium also defining axis of polarity, again, with a completely different set of molecules. And then one process that cell polarity is intimately connected with, which is sort of what we'd like to think about, is the concept of asymmetric cell division. And again, this is a process you see throughout biology, and I've just, again, picked a few examples from various animal kingdoms. So you see, obviously, you see quite clearly in animals, this is a neuroblast or a neural stem cell asymmetric division. You see examples of asymmetric division even in archaea. You see it in bacteria. This is Colobacter. Has clear polarity, settles down, undergoes an asymmetric division that essentially allows it to regenerate itself in terms of in this stalked form, which is the proliferative form, and give off to this swarmer cell that can go off and colonize new environments. We see it in the classic example of budding yeast, and also in plants. And at this point, I just not only want to stress this diversity of types of cells that undergo asymmetric division, but one thing to note is there are certain similarities. So in all these cases, you tend to form, although this one we don't know, but for these other ones, you tend to form in all of these examples clear membrane-associated domains that help define this axis of polarity. Now, importantly, it's unlike certain things like DNA and some of the DNA replication machinery. The machinery that drives polarity in these different systems is actually also quite highly diverse. So this, in generally, these systems, although there's a little bit of similarity between these two, generally the systems that drive polarity in these systems are completely separate. Right? So biology has had to solve this problem multiple times, and it's done so using multiple mechanisms. All right. So the polarity system that we study in the lab is so-called par polarity, and this is essentially unique to animals, so it's conserved throughout all metazoans, but again, operates in a large variety of cells and tissue context. So for example, we see it playing a key role in the sort of early organization of oocytes and embryos. So this is the Drosophila embryo, and here it's defined in the anterior-posterior axis, and defining here the posterior pole. As I mentioned, so epithelia show this very distinct apical basal polarity, and the pars are critically involved here in defining this apical versus basolateral organization. We see it playing a role in some motility. So here, this is par 3 localizing to the leading edge of this immune cell, this migrating immune cell. And we see it popping up in numerous cases of stem cells in asymmetric division, which is mostly what I'm going to talk about today. So in this case, so I'll get to this in a bit when I highlight the PAR protein. So essentially, PAR polarity is driven by a conserved set of proteins. And here, we're typically labeling two opposing classes of PAR proteins, and here we're labeling opposing ones. So for example, this is a protein called PAR 3, and this is PAR 1. So they're parts of the opposing sort of form opposing families, and I'll touch base on this. This is also a PAR 1 homolog and PAR 3. This here would be PAR 3 AP6. So essentially, we're tagging the individual PAR proteins, and you can generally see that they partition into these distinct membrane domains. Now, the system we use to study this process is the nematode C. elegans. And there are a number of reasons why this is a really nice system. Not sort of least of all, the PAR proteins were actually identified in a series of genetic screens using this organism, looking for loss of asymmetry in this very first cell division. So this is the fertilized embryo, so the zygote or one cell stage, and it's already acquired PAR polarity. And defects in this essentially revealed the identity of these so-called partitioning defective proteins. But in fact, PAR polarity in this system operates again in many different contexts. So this is in the one cell stage defining. I'll get into this, defining an asymmetric cell division, asymmetric inheritance of cell fate, and anterior posterior body axis specification. A bit later, it's involved in sort of inside out polarity of the embryo. So this is sort of the outside of the embryo. And you can see these red proteins here now localized here to these exposed surfaces, and these proteins typically are found here basolaterally. And then you typically find these PAR proteins also associated with various types of epithelial tissue. So for example, here, I'm not sure how well you can see this, but this is the forming intestine of the worm. And you can see, again, right, so this is a cell type that's contacting the environment. And right here, you can see these proteins essentially. This is a typical apical protein that would be found here and is now found here lining the intestine, the wall of the intestine, and then you have these this basolateral protein here extending away, right? So that would be the thing. And you see this repeatedly in other epithelials, so the intestine, you see it in vulval specification, you see it in the formation of the pharynx. So there's lots of places where we can use the elegans to tackle the process of cell polarity. It has a number of other advantages, like flies. It has a very well-developed genetic toolkit. We can make mutants. We can very easily deplete proteins in the RNAi. Also, for these kinds of imaging experiments, it's quite nice because the worm and the embryos are all transparent, so you can do live imaging. So this is, for example, taken from a dissected embryo directly out of this worm. You can also image them directly in utero. One nice feature for studying early development is sort of the nature of the reproductive system. So these are two, this is the adult worm. Here are the two gonad arms. So these are the reproductive structures. And this is a syncytium. So you have all sorts, you have sort of a mitotic zone here, a meiotic zone here, you butt off oocytes here at the end. There's a little organ here that's not really shown, that's a spermatheca. This holds sperm. So these are also hermaphrodites. So they basically go through a phase where they make sperm. The sperm then crawl into this little organ called the spermatheca. You make an oocyte right here at the distal end of this gonad. All of these cells contribute to adding proteins and mRNA into this oocyte. It buds off, goes through the spermatheca, gets fertilized, and you start development. And it does this about every 20 minutes. So in fact, if you look at any given young adult worm, you'll see an oocyte, an embryo undergoing meiosis 1, meiosis 2, 1-cell stage, 2-cell stage, 4-cell stage. So you have kind of a nice temporal collection of development in every worm that you pick up off the plate. They also grow really fast. So in 3 days, you have a complete cycle from adult to adult. And then the sort of first place where they came, I think, really in prominence was in developmental studies of cell lineage. So this is what the Nobel Prize in 2002 was for. Essentially, this observation that, so this adult worm has 959 somatic cells, essentially, exactly. And we know the identity of every one of those cells, and you can trace back the lineage of any given cell in this adult animal. So we know exactly where each cell comes from, who its parents are, what its siblings are. We can go through all the patterns of asymmetric divisions. We know exactly which cells are going to die, which cells are going to survive. So we essentially have a complete map of the transformation of this organism from oocyte to adult, which is something you don't find in a lot of other systems, which has made it a very rich system for trying to understand the process of cell lineage specification and cell phase specification. And so at this point, I'm going to kind of launch into what we work on specifically. And this is sort of taking advantage of one lineage here that we're particularly interested in. That's the so-called P lineage. So this P lineage is essentially the lineage that's going on to give rise to the reproductive tissue of the worm. So it's this lineage that's going to maintain germline identity, so essentially the reproductive totipotent potential, and it's going to go on to form the founder cells of these gonads that I showed you in the previous slide. Right. And so this lineage is set up very early on in the embryo. So you have this, soon after, essentially after fertilization, you have this cell called P0. So this is the one-cell embryo, or zygote. And then, essentially, to get to these two founder stem cells of this adult gonad, you essentially have to go through a program of four asymmetric cell divisions. And so if P4 divides here asymmetrically into an anterior and a posterior cell, this retains germline identity. And then this process is repeated several times until you get to this P4 cell, which then divides symmetrically to give rise to a pair of these stem cells, which essentially one for each of these gonad arms. And so you can see in each of these cases, you have to undergo a very specific asymmetric division that segregates these germline fate determinants into specifically one of the two daughter cells. And the reason we study this lineage is that each one of these asymmetric divisions in the early embryo is completely dependent on so-called par polarity. So each of these cells here from P0 to P3 polarizes using sort of the similar par machinery I sort of showed you in the previous slide, and drives an asymmetric division that's typically asymmetric both in size and in terms of the phase that the cells inherit. And just to sort of give you a sense of this, this is a movie we've taken with one of these germline markers. So this marker, this is actually one of the par proteins. It segregates into this germ lineage. This is the one cell stage. It's polarized. And then what you can see is that in each of these cells, it will become asymmetric, and then is asymmetrically segregated. This happens 1, 2, 3, 4 times until you generate this P4 cell. This P4 cell then migrates and divides symmetrically as if the cells are internalized into the center of the organism.
What are the C and D fates?
These fates, everything that's not P is going to be somatic tissue. Right, so they're going to do different things. So for example, MS is going to tend to be muscle, E is going to give you a lot of epithelial cells, intestinal cells. This is where your neurons are going to come from, various things like that.
I think that it's localizing on that broad band of, it looks broader than the cortex, but...
So what I'm showing you here, this is a projection. Okay. So this is a 3D, so we've done a Z stack through the embryo. So essentially, if I showed you just a cross-section, it would be quite thin. It would just be the membrane. So these proteins are really...
This is sort of a region of the cortex, but projected.
Yeah, so this is actually the whole embryo where we've done a Z projection through the whole system, and then we're just doing a maximum Z projection through. Right? So here you can kind of see a little bit of PAR proteins here on the surface of the membrane. So this is the bit facing the cover slip. Right? And then as you kind of go around, right, these are going to be your different... Z slices.
So it's a short transition.
It's touching the cover slip, isn't it?
Yeah, it's basically, this is pressed right up against the cover slip. Right? So this one's really flat, so you're looking through a very thin section here. You're kind of averaging in Z.
So we're going to come back to this. I'm just trying to understand. So C and D are products of asymmetric division of P cells, right?
Yes.
And I'm trying to understand. Right? So there are... Right, so the first asymmetric division of P1 gave EMS, the second gave C, and the third gave D.
Yes.
Are they all different?
Yes. So every one of the lineages is different, right? So in each division you're generating a different cell type. Yeah.
So is it different autonomously, or is it different because they actually receive different signals from the neighbors?
So. Generally, for the P lineage, the initial fate choice is cell autonomous. So you can dissect out any one of these P cells, it will still undergo an asymmetric division and give rise to cells that have these sort of distinct fates, and particularly the P fate is cell autonomous. So you can basically pull off P1, so it'll divide asymmetrically. You can take P2, pull it apart, it will divide asymmetrically, give rise to P3, and so on. In terms of the other fates, a lot of the other fates of these other cells ultimately are a combination of the fact that you've inherited an asymmetric fate from a particular P cell, but then also you have the information from contact. So for example, there's a significant amount of signaling between EMS and P2, and this is essential for essentially the definition of the E and the MS lineages. Right? So you'll have each one of these sort of junctions here between P3 and sort of EMS E, you have Wnt signaling, for example, that helps drive the fate of E. But for the P lineage, it's cell autonomous. Okay. Thought I saw some hands. No? Okay. All right, good. Interruption is good. All right. Okay, so now... I'm going to focus mostly on the polarization of this initial one cell stage, because this is what we understand the best, mainly because it's quite easy to do RNAi genetic rundown experiments, because you can RNAi a protein in the gonad and generate an embryo potentially depleted for this process and look at the effects of polarity mutants on this one cell stage. It's also quite big, great for imaging. The problem is if you disrupt polarity here, you essentially can't access some of these other stages, but I'll show you some ways that we can get around that later. All right, so PAR polarity in the one-cell embryo. So here I'm just going to start to introduce you to the PAR proteins themselves and what they do. So as I sort of briefly alluded to, you have two kind of sort of classes of PAR proteins. So you have this class here, which are essentially labeled in red. This embryo is about half an hour post-fertilization, and you find that these proteins here, PAR6, PAR3, APKC, it's not that important at this point what they are. These are essentially scaffolding proteins, and this is a protein kinase. This is a very conserved set of three proteins found throughout animals, and essentially every polarized, parpolarized cell, you'll have these three proteins. They start out here around the surface of the embryo. And then you have this other class of proteins, which for reasons will become obvious, we call the posteriors. So these are going to be called the anterior proteins. These we call the posterior proteins. And these start out, at least just prior to symmetry breaking, confined to the cytoplasm. These are labeled, we've labeled this one part protein here, part two in blue. And then down here, what you'll see is this thing also labeled in blue is a centrosome. So centrosomes are sort of these key microtubule organizing centers. I don't know if you've talked about them at all in the course. They're often found at the spindle poles. This comes in with the sperm. So the oocyte essentially devoid of centrosomes. The maternal ones are degraded. And then the male sperm donates the centrosome along with its DNA, which here is labeled in red. And essentially, this is where the process of polarity gets kicked off. So there's a cue that originates with this centrosome that becomes active around the end of meiosis that we still don't fully understand. But one of the key things that it does is it changes and induces this asymmetry in the actomyosin cortex. So I don't know if this has really been touched on much so far, but essentially, around this embryo, just under the surface, there's a layer of cross-linked actin and myosin, right? And so the myosin is essentially generating contractile stress within this network. And you can essentially see this, it's quite highly pulsatile. So we're essentially just looking at the membrane here. And then what happens is due to this cue from the centrosome, you down-regulate or induce an asymmetry in the contractility of this network so that it essentially retracts away or flows away from the posterior pole. Right, and you can kind of see this activity of this sort of pulsatile network in this ruffling of the cell membrane here. Right, and then this process of cortical flow is actually something discovered by Edmund Rowe, who's going to be here later this week. So I think Thursday is C. elegans day. So I'm a bit early. So he may talk a little bit more about this. Sorry.
So this process is not fertilization. It doesn't depend on.
So it's a bit more complicated. So the original sort of story is you tend to polarize. So you'll have an oocyte. The sperm will fertilize. It tends to fertilize. So see this thing here? This is a polar body. So you know when you go through meiosis, you have to separate out your chromosomes. And so you essentially at meiosis one you give off a polar body, and then at meiosis two you give off a second polar body, and that's here. Typically, because of the orientation of the oocyte as it goes through the sperm-containing organ, the spermatheca, will tend to be fertilized on the opposite side, somewhere in this hemisphere, right? And so typically, what you'll find is that polarity then, because that's where the centrosome is, polarity will be aligned along that axis, right? But in fact, sometimes you can fertilize near the polar body. There's nothing that says you can't. And in that case, you just polarize from this side, and then if I just rotate the movie by 180 degrees, it essentially looks exactly the same. So essentially, there is no polarity in the system until you activate this centrosome cue. Because you can actually fertilize the embryo, centrifuge it, move the centrosome to some other location, and that's where polarity will be initiated. So this is where the initial spatial information comes from. Right? And just to stress, this is all inside of an eggshell, so it's not receiving any other contacts from the external environment to sort of orient polarity.
So the centrosome cue is somewhat dependent on the sperm entry.
So the centrosome cue is requires sperm entry, and because you need the centrosome there, and then this essentially will then recruit maternal proteins and activate maternal proteins that are then presumably communicating the spatial cue. Make sense?
Even if it comes in on the top, it would still align with the long axis.
Yeah, so there's a process. So typically, it will never fertilize directly at the poles, just by chance, in terms of probabilities. And so if you form here, for example, you'll see here the centrosome is here. Maybe it'll be obvious when I play the movie. So as this, essentially at the same time that these flows are happening, this actomyosin reorganization, you see the emergence of polarity in the oocyte. So what you can see is that these anterior part proteins become segregated along with this flowing actomyosin cortex into an anterior domain. And this allows the formation of these sort of posterior proteins to load onto the posterior membrane. All right, and so if I play this alludes to the student question. What you can see is that the centrosome, sort of at that initial phase, at that initial state, sort of this initial symmetry breaking set. Oh, sorry. Clicker malfunction. Okay. Too many animations on the slide. A lesson for everybody. Right. Essentially, what you see is that this moves over here to the pole. Right. So wherever centrum initially is, it's going to tend to align with the long axis and get sort of trapped along one of the two poles. You can actually make spherical embryos using various mutants, and then essentially it doesn't matter, right? And most of polarity is fine, although the embryos tend to have problems later on. This is a process called posteriorization. I can go into it more in detail maybe at another time. Essentially, it's also dependent on these flows and cytoplasmic flows in terms of essentially trapping the structure against one of the two things, due to shape.
Before the segregation of these two proteins into domains with this sort of furrow, you see, we see a lot of kind of spurious furrows, which, as physicists, would say, oh, is the codex unstable? Right? So, do we know something about it? Is there a contractility increase which will make some sort of this sort of instability? So we see here a lot of
this one.
Different furrows. No. Here, just on the surface, we see that it's very unstable in the surface.
This bit, yeah. So I mean, that's this sort of highly contractile meshwork, right? So it undergoes these pulses, and it will essentially drive sort of regions together, and that will pull in imagination. But then the lifetime of any one of those foci is only about 30 seconds to a minute, right? Because then they'll dissolve. And there's actually a lot of work on sort of trying to understand the mechanics of this. And there's two models for how these foci come about. And I don't know if Thomas Lecuy talked about any of this during his talk, but you know, there's purely mechanical ideas where you essentially form a network and then you constrict it, and that process can cause the instability of the focus itself. In the case of C. elegans, I think the current thinking is that you actually have sort of other kind of patterning system, presumably in terms of row regulation, that sort of determines where you form a focus and what its lifetime is. So you get these kind of pulses of row activity that sort of form, and you often tend to find the next pulse in a region that didn't have it before. So you have kind of this oscillatory behavior in the cortex. That gives rise to
the furrows are exactly correlated with these pulses.
I've never actually gone and looked, but what you often see is you'll see a very deep invagination, and you can kind of sort of see a bridge of actin cables kind of over that area. And if you disrupt actin or downregulate contractility, the furrows are completely gone, right? So you have a completely smooth cortex.
In a circular cell, would the centrosome still move after fertilization, or would it just stay on the edge?
It floats around, but then once you break symmetry and you polarize, it will kind of stay trapped where it is.
It can
move kind of randomly because there's no shape to constrain it.
It's the point where posterior par begins to accumulate quite variable and is the closest distance to the centrosome at that.
Yeah, so there's been a series of papers recently, one by Carrie Cowan, when she was at the IMP in Vienna. And basically what she showed is that if you look at sort of where this initial symmetry breaking event was in terms of the flows and the sort of smoothing of the cortex away from the contractile bit, and that always correlated with the cortex that was closest to the centrosome. So, but it didn't necessarily require that the centrosome actually touch the cortex. So there was some ability of the centrosome to act at a distance, but that almost invariably the place where you initially clear the myosin, so you flow away, and you initially load the pars, is sort of that region of the centrosome, that place where the centrosome is closest in sort of 3D space to the
centrosome. Think of sort of the gradient signal coming out from the centrosome?
I think people are just speculating at this point, because I think the key thing is we don't know what the actual cue is. So her model was that there was some sort of either diffusible signal or perhaps something. So, right, these are microtubule nucleators. And so one model is that these microtubules are making connections to the cortex. And so you might make the most connections in the cortex closest to the centrum is. So either one of those models would be a way of delivering a local cue to downregulate contractility and drive symmetry breaking.
So I understand the centrosome polarizes the contractility, but what sets it off during oocyte development? Is it fertilization dependent that you start getting the contractile network, or does that just happen?
So what you tend to find is there's a bunch of regulatory pathways that kick in sort of at the oocyte embryo transition, and a lot of things happen right at the end of meiosis II. So essentially, symmetry breaking in terms of the sort of standard symmetry breaking pathway happens within minutes of the end of meiosis II. So there's something at the end of meiosis II. The myosin will become much more dynamic. So before you have some contractile elements.
Before fertilization.
So sorry, I should have clarified. So the oocytes arrested, right? In prophase of meiosis I. It gets activated, goes through the spermatheca, becomes fertilized, and then sort of really progresses through meiosis I. So after fertilization, you go through meiosis I and meiosis II. During that entire stage, the paternal DNA stays compacted, and the centrosome stays dormant. So essentially, you don't see any activity. You can almost not see it. Right? And then right around the end of meiosis II, something happens, and the centrosome starts to mature. And it's exactly that time when the centrosome starts to mature that the symmetry breaking gets kicked off. And what we do know is that if you block centrosome maturation through various mutants involved in centrosome assembly, you can delay or, in some cases, abolish symmetry breaking. Right? So that centrosome maturation is absolutely critical.
And the contractility doesn't start until after, I mean, the contractility overall in the cortex.
So this sort of really dynamic contractile cortex comes on right at the end of meiosis II. If you get rid of the centrosome II, it will also be quite active and contractile, but you won't break symmetry. Right? So the sort of what I argue is sort of the basic ideas are that the PAR proteins are there, the PAR proteins are becoming active, and we have a project that I'm not going to talk about in terms of that the PAR proteins sort of enter a sort of a poised state also around meiosis II, then that doesn't seem to be dependent strictly on fertilization. The cortex organization doesn't depend on fertilization, but this sort of activation of the spatial cue is completely dependent on the centrosome. Right? So you have sort of a set of pathways that get the system poised to polarize, and then you activate the spatial cue in the form of the centrosome. Right. Okay. So then what are these PAR proteins doing? They're not just there to make membrane domains. So at around the same time that these proteins are becoming confined to these sort of two opposing domains that define the anteroposterior axis, they're communicating with a number of downstream pathways in the cytoplasm. So here, for example, are these germline P granules. They're associated with a number of germline mRNAs and proteins, and you can see that these become segregated into this posterior half, and this is completely dependent on these PAR protein being able to form domains on the membrane. Right? So essentially, this is driving, this is polarity at the membrane, asymmetry at the membrane, driving polarity of the cytoplasm, such that as the cell goes through mitosis and undergoes division, you essentially have this highly unequal division where all these fate determinants are sort of segregated into this posterior cell, which, as you know from the previous slide, is P1. Right? This is the germline. This is the start of the germline lineage. And so essentially, if you think about the system, there are a number of questions we really want to address. Right, so one is obviously how do you communicate a sort of transient centrosomal spatial cue into these domains? How do the PAR proteins respond to this? How do we define domains in a sense? How do these PARs maintain the identity of the domains? How do they define boundaries between these domains? And how are they communicating from the membrane into the cytoplasm to establish cytoplasmic asymmetries and cytoplasmic polarity? So
how much time goes between polarization and the appearance of the cleavage furrow?
So the process from symmetry breaking to the appearance of the cleavage furrow varies with temperature, but it's typically between about 18 and 25 minutes.
And during this time, you need to polarize?
Yes. So it's actually, essentially, by this sort of entry into sort of mitosis proper in terms of metaphase and assembly of the spindle, most of the polarity proteins are already set up. So in fact, you go from no polarity to being almost fully polarized within the span of 10 minutes or less. And so it's an incredibly rapid process. So in some cases, it's very different from sort of Drosophila oocyte that emerges over polarity emerging over hours. Okay. So these are kind of some of the questions that we're really trying to tackle in the lab. And so at this point, I'm just going to walk you through a bit about sort of the models for how we think about this process working. So this gets back to an earlier question: what are these PAR proteins? What am I labeling here? So, as I said, typically we think of these as sort of two classes of proteins. These, as I said, they're the anterior. They're going to define this anterior domain, and these the posterior. All of these proteins are membrane associated. They're not integral membrane proteins, so they're all capable of reversibly binding and unbinding the membrane. And the idea generally is that when they're on the membrane, they're able to antagonize each other's localization. And the way this is generally thought to work is, for example, here, this APKC, or atypical protein kinase C, is a kinase, and it's known to phosphorylate at least these three posterior members, and it's this phosphorylation is thought to essentially drive them off the membrane if they happen to show up in the wrong domain, right? So you have a phosphorylation to process of exclusion. And similarly, you have this protein PAR1, which is known to phosphorylate PAR3, and at least in most systems where it's been looked at, this phosphorylation of PAR3 essentially renders PAR3 unable to bind the membrane. So again, you can think of a similar process happening in reverse, that you have these sort of cross-phosphorylation events that modulate the ability of these proteins to associate with the membrane. This protein CDC42, it's a small GTPase, so typically it's found in two states, an inactive state and an active GTP-bound state. And recently, I don't know if Ed's going to talk about some of this work, but this CHIN1 molecule was found to be a GAP, so a GTPase activating protein for CDC42. Even though it's a GTPase activating protein, essentially what that does is it downregulates this because it triggers the transition from GTP active CDC42 state, hydrolyzes the GTP to form GDP, which is the inactive state. So essentially, this is another route to antagonize the activity and localization of this anterior PAR complex. So essentially, you have this sort of reciprocal antagonistic feedback loop in the system that's essential for this intracellular patterning event. And you can see this using RNAi experiments. So for example, if you deplete posterior proteins, you tend to see the anterior PARs now spreading posteriorly into the posterior half of the embryo. If you do the converse experiment and get rid of any one of these anterior PAR proteins, you see that the posterior PAR proteins are now found uniformly throughout the membrane. All right, and so it's only, so this sort of brings home this idea of competition. It's only when they're both there and the activity of these two sets are balanced that you can drive the formation of this stably polarized state.
Can you overexpress proteins in the system?
Yes, it's difficult, but we have to some degree, yes.
So the natural prediction is that if you flood the system with PPAR,
yeah,
you would lose the ability to break symmetry.
Yeah, so I have a couple slides on this a little bit later, but essentially the idea here is that there is a balance, and what you find is that if you perturb the dosage of these, so for example, in certain heterozygous mutants, what you find is that actually the size of the domains varies, right? So we can actually overproduce to some degree PAR2 and alter the size of this domain. I'll show you some slides about that a little bit later. One of the tricks is to overproduce these proteins, you need to sort of add an extra copy and induce it. And if it disrupts polarity, it's also going to be lethal. And so the trick is, what we're not very good at doing, so we can kind of modulate the dosage somewhat within a range. But making a line that makes way too much PAR2 is going to be lethal, and we're never going to be able to get the transgenic lines. And there's not a lot of really good inducible expression systems that are good for overexpressing just within the one cell slates in a very specific way. We're trying to figure out a way around that, but at this point we haven't done it.
How exactly are they associating with the membrane? And is there any information in membrane lipid composition, or is there a transmembrane protein, or
so
what's the link?
As far as we know, there's no transmembrane proteins that are essential for the process. They're all what we call peripheral membrane proteins, so they're binding and unbinding. Most of them have some form of lipid binding activity. So for example, PAR1 has sort of a cryptic pH domain that can bind membrane. It also binds PAR2. PAR2 has sort of a charged stretch that's capable of associating with the membrane on its own. Same thing is true for LGL. CHIN1, we don't know. CDC42 has a lipid anchor. So this has this lipid anchor that folds out and can go to the membrane. PAR3 has some lipid binding activity. So for example, it can bind phosphoinositides on a PIP strip. And there's certain domains of PAR3 that will go up on their own to the membrane. PAR6 doesn't have any membrane activity, but right, it's going to interact with PAR3 and also going to interact with PKC. And PKC also has sort of this domain that can sort of bind very generic membranes. Negatively.
So there's no evidence that, say, different phosphoinositide compositions.
So in terms of PAR polarity, I don't think there's any good evidence that the phosphoinositides or lipid asymmetries drive this. We did a little bit of screening for using certain markers, GFP-labeled probes for different fossil events, and we don't see any strong asymmetries that would explain it. And mutants in those pathways don't necessarily have polarity phenotypes. So we don't think there's anything intrinsic about the membrane that's asymmetric, but the part proteins are really driving it. But they do require sort of generic negatively charged lipids on the membrane to form the scaffold. Yeah.
From the picture you show, it seems that the polarity goes beyond the polarity that you find at the membrane, but even inside the yolk, it seems that you have some kind of a polarity.
You mean from this picture?
Yes.
Yeah, so that...
It seems really that you have, for example, PPAR in the yolk, which is closer to the PPAR membrane protein.
Yeah, so I think, so I think one of the issues here is, this cell is kind of three-dimensional, right? And you will get a little bit of background fluorescence, right? So if you look sort of here near the membrane, you have sort of some curvature, and that's going to provide some out-of-plane fluorescence, right? So it's actually, there were some initial observations on localization of these using wide-field imaging that show a very nice cytoplasmic gradient of PAR proteins. But we've gone back and tried to look at this using two-photon and really careful confocal, where we really bring the pinhole way down so that we're as confocal as possible. And if you do that, you really suppress most of the asymmetry that you see in the cytoplasm. Right. So if you really look hard for a cytoplasmic gradient of PAR proteins, with trying to be as rigorous as you are to exclude out-of-plane fluorescence, you really don't see cytoplasmic fluorescence. Now, the caveat I will say is that one of the PAR proteins, PAR1, has been reported to form a cytoplasmic gradient. And the idea is that this one has sort of a dual localization between the membrane and the cytoplasm, and that it may be this ability of this protein to form an activity gradient in the cytoplasm that essentially drives that cytoplasmic polarity that I showed you in a previous slide. Right? But I think there is very clear compartmentalization, at least between these proteins and most of these proteins, really only forming a pattern on the membrane. PAR1 maybe being the sort of membrane to cytoplasm communicator, and then you have a whole bunch of cytoplasmic polarity pathways that come downstream. Okay.
You said that if you remove any of these proteins, the polarity would not be stable. I bet that you can actually downregulate PAR2, and LGL would provide a rescue pathway.
Yes. So for these proteins here, so these are the very highly conserved PARs you find in almost every system. Every single one of these is absolutely essential. To get rid of any of those, you lose polarity. For the posterior proteins, it's a bit more variable. So in a wild-type embryo with no other mutations, if you get rid of PAR2, you lose polarity, and you'll have a symmetric division. However, you can rescue that by overexpressing LGL. So if you put in a transgene that expresses a bit more LGL than normal, you can now rescue the embryo for the lack of PAR2. If you get rid of CHIN1, you see only minor sort of defects. You see a slight sort of posterior expansion. Similarly with PAR1, actually, sort of the initial symmetry breaking is normal, but then you see it drift back. And again, Ed may talk a little bit about this. He's done some work looking at sort of synergy between, so for example, this CDC42-dependent inhibition and PAR1-dependent inhibition. So the picture for the anterior proteins is quite clear. They're all required, and I really think act primarily through localization of APKC, whereas for the posterior PAR proteins, it's still a bit nebulous precisely how these are regulating the activity in the anterior.
Does one know if APKC really binds to the cortex by itself, or is it really always connected to PAR3 proteins?
So if you get rid of any of these other three proteins, you don't see PKC at the membrane.
Okay.
Right? So under normal circumstances, it absolutely requires the other partners to get to the membrane. That said, there is sort of some recent results that suggest that this lipid binding activity of PKC, if it's unmasked in the correct way, that PKC can associate with the membrane by itself. It's just under normal circumstances that binding domain is kept in check, right? And so then when you activate the complex, that you could then load to the membrane. So there's a lot of complexity, and I have sort of a story I can tell you about this, but we're clearly not going to get there today. So maybe I can talk about it another time. So I think on the face of it, at a very coarse grain level, you have this mutually antagonistic pathway with reciprocal feedback, glossing over some of the, there's obviously quite a bit of sort of detailed regulation and complexity in each of these things. I mean, presumably that's why you have so many proteins involved in the system. Okay. Right. So, so one key ingredient really in the system is this idea of mutual antagonism, and this really emerged. This idea emerged very early on in terms of the genetics of the system due to the sort of ability of RNAi of these proteins to drive the collapse. But this is really, all this is really telling you is it's describing sort of the local interactions that essentially drive the membrane into sort of an A or a P state. So you can think of this as sort of a local self-amplifying feedback loop where, you know, the membrane, because of this mutual antagonism, you're either going to be typically in an A state or a P state locally. But to really understand how this pattern emerges, we sort of felt like we needed to understand a bit more about the mobility of these proteins in the embryo. How are they moving in space, and how's that mobility regulated by, for example, these mutually antagonistic interactions? And so you can do some relatively simple experiments to get a handle on some of this mobility. So this is a fluorescence recovery after photobleaching experiment. For those of you not familiar with this, essentially here, for example, we're looking at the membrane. These are GFP-labeled PARP proteins. They're fluorescent. We're not doing anything else to them. And then essentially at a given time, we're going to use a high-intensity light source to locally inactivate the fluorophore in a particular region, and then we're going to ask how fluorescent molecules repopulate that space. So it sounds like from the nods, most people know what this is. Right? And so you can do this for the PARP proteins. You can see that they're quite dynamic. These are for PAR6 and PAR2 on the membrane, turning over on the order of tens of seconds. You can do this in different places in the embryo. So for example, at the membrane, you see for a given bleep size here, this is about a 5 micron square, you get recovery on the order of tens of seconds. If you then move into the cytoplasm, you see recoveries on the order of about a second for a similarly sized spot. Right, so clearly PAR proteins are highly dynamic, and as you may expect from the cytoplasm, seem to be quite freely diffusive here and recover quite quickly with high mobility. And there's a bit of a mobility shift between the two states.
But it doesn't recover in the cytoplasm. It doesn't recover in the cytoplasm.
So here, this one. Right, so this part, so you get recovery to about 50%. So the problem with bleaching, whenever you do bleaching experiment, is that you're going to use a cone of light, right? And so essentially, when you try to bleach a small square here in the cytoplasm, right, you're going to be bleaching a large 3D volume, right? And then, because these are moving relatively quickly, any particle that comes through that 3D volume during the bleach time will tend to be bleached. So in fact, we sort of say we're bleaching a small square here, but in fact, we're bleaching a relatively large volume of the cytoplasm. And because the bleaching is irreversible, right, here you have no bleach particles. Now you bleach in your local region, which depletes your overall pool within the cell. And so now when you go to recover, you have essentially this gap, and that gap reflects sort of the molecules that, the overall pool of molecules that you bleach. So in fact, for this experiment, you end up bleaching, a very significant fraction of your cytoplasmic pool when you do a bleaching experiment. Does that make sense?
Depends on the numbers, yeah, okay.
Yeah, no, it clearly depends on the numbers, right?
The membrane, do you have any way to know if it recovers by diffusion at the membrane or by turnover from the cytoplasm?
Exactly. So you can do, this is exactly kind of one of the questions we were trying to address in this. So, for example, if you take one of these bleached spots of the membrane and you look at how it recovers, right? So this is a chymograph. For those of you not familiar with this, essentially we're plotting fluorescence across the bleach area at different times. Here's your bleach spot. And then what you can see is you have a very clear outside-in recovery. So if it was just binding and unbinding to this bleach area, you expect that recovery would be uniform, right, across space, and it's clearly not. So this is really indicative of lateral diffusion. And single-molecule experiments, where we started to try and do single-molecule experiments, kind of confirm this idea that these molecules are diffusing in the plane of the membrane. Right, so you have a lot of free diffusion in the cytoplasm. They can bind to the membrane, but when they're on the membrane, they can also, they're also relatively free to undergo lateral diffusion in the plane of the membrane. And in fact, even here at this boundary between the two domains, here you'll have an initial gradient from going from high to low. You can bleach, and again, you see that the system recovers from the outside in. It's a bit asymmetric now because right here you have high and here you have low concentration, but the dynamics of the recovery is quite similar. So we don't think there's any evidence to believe that there's any sort of physical barrier sort of separating these two different membrane compartments, but rather these molecules are essentially constantly diffusing down this concentration gradient, and they're being somehow maintained that in the asymmetry through these reactions. And you can kind of see this, so one thing you can look at is if you plot fluorescence across this boundary, going from high to low, you see that there's sort of this extended gradient of molecules here. And if you calculate the sort of, you know, fit a length scale to this, this gradient, the number you get is roughly similar to the diffusion length that you measure using the Frappe experiment. So if you take essentially the diffusion rate you measure on the membrane and the lifetime at the membrane, calculate diffusion length, gives you a number on the order of 10 microns, which is about the same as this gradient length scale here. Right? So again, consistent with this idea that these molecules are diffusing, freely diffuse from regions of high to low concentration. And one nice thing is that the sort of measurements predict that the PAR6 gradient should be broader than the PAR2 gradient, and that's exactly what you see in embryos.
Did you also perform FCS experiments to compare Frappe values with FCS values?
So you can. So in the cytoplasm, you certainly can do that, and the number of measurements are quite close. FCS on the membrane is a bit tricky because they're diffusing more slowly. And so you have to have other, you can't simply continuously sample one point. So there are different ways around that in terms of scanning FCS or various other mechanisms. The problem is also, you know, the membrane tends to fluctuate a bit. Right, so when we've tried to do that sort of on a single 2D plane, those membrane fluctuations also drive fluctuations that make it difficult to tease out the FCS data. So it's a bit tricky. Order of magnitude, they're quite similar, but they haven't been pretty similar. The single molecules, for instance, have been more informative. And those, again, are sort of seem broadly consistent.
It seems like the for the two, part two and part six, this length is more or less the same. So shall we infer that the diffusion is more or less the same, or the time scale is very different?
They're actually both. They're both within an order of a factor of two of each other, right? So PAR6 diffuses a bit faster, and is on the membrane for about the same amount of time as PAR2 within our sort of measurement errors. So they're actually they are quite symmetric in terms of time scales. I mean, in terms of length scales, in terms of both. I think for PAR6, it's 0.1. Our Frappe data said 0.16 microns squared per second for PAR5. Six, it was 0.25. So very similar, actually.
And do the other anterior lens have the same kind of shape of the gradient or diffusion?
PKC is essentially, it looks identical to this when we looked at it. We haven't done the quantitative measurements on it because we haven't had lines until very recently. PAR3 also has a gradient, although it looks a bit different. So there's definitely going to be something interesting in terms of thinking about PAR3 versus PAR6 PKC, and I was going to tell you about some stuff we've done on that, but
we'll
have to jettison that, I think, at this point, maybe another day. But generally, all the proteins form gradients. The membrane, and they have this sort of boundary region. Right, so you have this kind of picture that shows up where, okay, if we want to concentrate a protein in space here on the membrane, the diffusion is going to tend to counteract this, right? So you're going to have to expend a significant amount of energy to enrich this protein in the membrane in one space. And that's essentially where we think these sort of reaction terms coming in, this mutual antagonism, that somehow is able to bias local dissociation and local association to sort of drive the continuous enrichment here, which is constantly going to be dissipated by diffusion, right? So in fact, if you have a polarized system at steady state, you essentially have molecules diffusing down the concentration gradient, undergoing some differential association and dissociation, mixing the cytoplasm, and then sort of reloading here. So essentially, you can think of this as sort of a continuous cycle or flux of protein through the system, all driven by these sort of mutual antagonistic events, presumably through phosphorylation.
So this antagonism depends, as you mentioned, on the kinases.
Yes.
So we also have phosphatases in the system?
Presumably, but we don't know what they are. I haven't been looked at. Okay, so just to sort of, so what we can do is, based on this kind of picture and some of the data we have, you can build a relatively simple model to describe this. It's maybe somewhat elementary for some of you, but essentially the way we capture this is we have these two species that diffuse on the membrane. They can bind and unbind the membrane with kinetic parameters that we measured in the Frappe. You can describe this in simple partial differential equations, a diffusion term, an on rate, an off rate. As I showed you, cytoplasmic diffusion is relatively rapid, so we have good cytoplasmic mixing, and the time scale of this process is very fast, and we think essentially you're loading this embryo with a fixed amount of protein, right? So you can treat this essentially is a well-mixed cytoplasmic pool for this, for the case of this relatively simple model. Yeah?
So that actually, similar to that question, so phosphatases kind of need to be in the cytoplasm, otherwise we have less and less A and G.
Agreed, yeah, exactly. So presumably, presumably you are, there is some sort of phosphatase in there that's turning over. Generally, right, phosphatases are quite broad spectrum, so it's hard to figure out by doing just RNA experiments of different phosphatases or phosphatase subunits to find the specific ones for these pathways. I think in some systems they're known, so I think there's some evidence in fly for PP2 playing a role, I think. But in worms it hasn't been explored.
But the total number of proteins which is able to bind seems more or less to stay the same.
We don't have any reason to think it's different. So if you look before and after symmetry breaking and you try to quantify total protein amount, you don't see a significant change. You can polarize in the presence of cyclohexamide where you're not making any more protein and fluorescent levels don't drop. So again, it doesn't seem to be like localized production and degradation. Whether there's some change, like you say, in sort of the total pool that's available for membrane binding, we haven't been able to look at that. Right, so again, because this is a well-mixed pool, we can essentially calculate the instantaneous cytoplasmic concentration from the total amount minus the amount of the membrane. And then we sort of have to capture sort of this mutual antagonism. The precise sort of kinetics that govern this, the precise reactions that govern this are more complicated, as we kind of alluded to. But you can kind of capture the essential feature by adding sort of an extra off rate here, where this off rate is dependent on the local concentration of the antagonist. So it's one way to do it. I think there are a number of ways you could put this in, but for the sake of argument, it's sort of a simple two-component model where you have essentially this sort of bistable reciprocal feedback loop coupled to these sort of reaction and diffusion behaviors. Right, and you can take this model, start it off in a polarized state, and ask if it can sustain polarity, and in fact you see that it can. So the state is essentially stable, and you see that it roughly replicates what you see in embryos. Right, so you have these extended gradients at midplane, and that the red gradient is ever so slightly longer than the blue, and that's again what you see in the embryo.
Is this in one dimension, or is this?
This is in one dimension. We've done a model where we've tried to take into account curvature, didn't have any big effects, but we haven't tried to do it in 2D.
Did you measure all the on and off rates, or how they fitted?
So the on, off, and diffusion terms for the model are based on the measurements for part 2 and part 6. Right, so we're kind of taking part 2 and part 6 as proxies for these two affected species.
And you got the on and off rates from the FRAP.
So you get the off rate from the FRAP, and then if you know the concentration of the membrane versus cytoplasm and estimate that, I mean, it's a bit of a messy measurement, but you can then extrapolate roughly what the on rate is. The cross terms, we essentially have no idea what they are. You can kind of estimate how strong they need to be in the model, but we try to be agnostic on that.
And you... can you go back to the one? So you basically added for the cross terms two rates, right?
Yeah, so this is
alpha and the KC.
Yes, right? Yes. So this would be an equation for part two. There'd be a corresponding, essentially identical equation for A. And then here's your cross term where P depends on the local concentration of A with some constant, which we can't measure. We don't know. Sort of an effective thing. And we have an exponent here. And the key thing for this to work, so you need to locally be able to sort of go between an A and a P state, right? So these kind of have to be mutually exclusive states, and so this term has to be nonlinear. So either A or alpha or beta needs to be greater than 1. And as long as you do that, then the system generally works. So it's a very phenomenological description of the cross term.
Okay. So, I have a question. So since at the membrane, there is a population that never recovers, so are you considering that indeed this population is present?
So in the
if you go back to your common graph is clear. I mean, it never goes back to red. It always stays kind of bluish or yellowish at the fatty membrane.
Yeah. So
if you it's a very stable population.
So when we fit, when we fit FRAP experiments for part 6 and part 2, sort of in regimes where we try to minimize bleaching, which is tricky because you are bleaching some of the pool. Generally, we fit assuming 100% on recovery because generally we see no significantly reproducible global pool. Now, whether that's true for all the PAR proteins, we just haven't been able to go through every single one of them at this point. But at least the ones we've measured, on the membrane, we don't see a a significant immobile pool. So in fact, we think that they're completely turning over.
Would it be possible to do a two-photon frac just to be sure about this, this recovery?
So we tried this about 5-6 years ago to try to get at some of these questions. And at least at the time, the two photons we had access to actually were much less reproducible in terms of the data, because these measurements are somewhat messy or somewhat noisy already. The two photon added an additional noise component that made it actually harder to fit the data. So I think we were solving one problem but inducing another problem. We should probably go back and redo this. But right, the problem is, one of the benefits of using a normal confocal is that you have a slightly thicker bit that you bleach. So if there's sort of different thicknesses of the membrane, you kind of even those out. And the problem with two photon is, I think it's much more critical to be exactly in the right plane. And then if you do have sort of 3 dimensions in that 2D plane, you can add additional variability there. So we thought about that, but it didn't seem to help at the time. We should probably go back and do it again. You can do it sort of in a different geometry on the side, right, where you bleach kind of at midsection. So your Z plane is in the plane of the membrane, right? So instead of the membrane being here and bleaching a 2D square on edge, you essentially get the same numbers out. But again, because you don't have 2D, you have a little bit less information in terms of the fitting. So, okay. Right. So if we started the model off in a polarized state, it maintains polarity. But you might ask, what happens if you don't start with a polarized system, you don't give it any asymmetry to start with, and the system actually won't polarize spontaneously, so it's different from, say, sort of a classic Turing system where you get spontaneous symmetry breaking. And the reason this seems to be, so this is just a phase-space diagram where we're varying the sort of two cross-term rate constants. This is sort of for a generic parameter set, and what you can see is that this system is multi-stable. So you have sort of a region where the A homogeneous state is stable. We have a region where the P homogeneous, the posterior dominant state is stable. So this kind of reflects that local bistability between these reciprocal feedback interactions. You also have a region where you can maintain a polarized state, the sort of domain state. And in fact, it's a place in parameter space where you have all three, right? And so you could imagine if you go through parameter space something like this, you go from a state where only the anterior state is stable, cross into a state where both the anterior state, uniform state, and the domain state are possible, but you're sort of locked into an A state. And then as you cross this sort of this threshold here, now you transition to a region where you actually can get spontaneous symmetry breaking. Right? So the system itself can permit spontaneous symmetry breaking. But if we actually look at sort of the parameters we think are governing the model, this sort of crosshatched region here would be the region where you would have spontaneous symmetry breaking. This region is incredibly thin and narrow given our parameter set. In fact, we think we're living somewhere here, based on our sort of estimates of parameters, where we wouldn't have a system. So the system can polarize spontaneously, but we think the reaction terms constrain the system so that it can't. And in fact, that for a developmental system, that might be something that you like. You only want to polarize when you're at the right time and when you have a sort of a dedicated queue. And so what is that asymmetry? This comes back to this idea of these actomycin flows, right, that are flowing from posterior to anterior. These are driving sort of a series of recircling flows and transporting all sorts of things. So, for example, if you look at these cytoplasmic granules, you can see they go from sort of posterior to anterior along the membrane and circulate back through the cytoplasm. Right, so you're essentially generating flow of material along the membrane from posterior to anterior. And so the idea is that this could transport PAR proteins. And so you can put this into the model where you essentially allow the PAR proteins to be transported with sort of the velocity of this local actomycin flow. And that comes in here as this dot. And then we just show you the parameters of diffusion. We sort of plug that into our reaction diffusion model to ask, you know, would those sort of flow velocities that we see be sufficient to trigger polarity? And in fact, they are. So you can drive asymmetry in response to flows and flip the system into a sort of between a polarized, an unpolarized, and a polarized state. Right? And if you do chymographs.
Yeah. In the one-dimensional system, how do you model these recirculation flows?
So, you
can have periodic boundary conditions.
Yeah. So essentially, what we're doing in the model is I'm only showing you flows from posterior to anterior, and we're effectively ignoring the recirculating flow back into the cytoplasm, right? Because these PAR proteins, essentially, we're interested in this flow of PAR proteins at the membrane. Right, and when they're at the membrane, right, they have this reduced diffusion mobility. So in the cytoplasm, they're diffusing very quickly, So you're right. So if you just had a protein sitting in the cell, it would just go around and around and around and around, right? But essentially, because of the PAR proteins, when they bind the membrane, they slow down, or they're associated with the cortex, they slow down. The idea is that they're transported, and they're only transported in one direction. And then when they fall off, they're essentially well-mixed, and the diffusion dominates over the flow.
And the reason we have flows is because it's like something like a driven cavity flow, so you shear the membrane, and this drags the fluid with it and sets in motion.
Yeah, so I think that's essentially the idea, right? So the actomycin is going to flow along the membrane here, and essentially it's going to entrap various particles. It's going to interact with actin-binding proteins, anything that's associated with the cortex, and that would sort of drive a current. So if you look at vesicles, anything like this, presumably it can.
And so by PIV, you see these two vortices. So what?
Yeah, so so if you do PIV in the cytoplasm, you'll see sort of flow, these sort of recirculating vortices. Exactly, you'll see exactly that with
you
the
see two, right?
Yeah. They're sometimes a bit asymmetric depending on the precise positioning, but yeah.
What do you see in the vehicular cross section?
So if we went this way, you see something very similar. We haven't imaged it. It's a bit harder to do it that way. We don't see any obvious rotational asymmetry, but it's also not completely rotational asymmetric. So this is typically off-axis. Sometimes flows on one side are a little bit stronger than flows on the other. So it's not strictly rotationally symmetric, but there's nothing obviously asymmetric or reliably asymmetric about it.
So you think sort of like a torus, this thing?
Yeah, probably something like that. And not perfectly symmetric.
If the actomycin flow is symmetric and has this conical symmetry, what breaks this? So there has to be another symmetry breaking to have.
Well, I think you could think of it as a donut, right?
Right. You shear it as a cone, sort of, right?
Yeah, and then it comes back into the center. So I think that the idea is that that's sort of not going to, right? So you would. You flow out here, and then in the center, you would flow back to the pole. And actually, I think those flows back down the center are one of the things that help deal with this posteriorization that pin the centrosome of the nucleus here at one of the two poles.
Do you have to see that the posterior ones aren't affected by actin flows, or is it enough just to have this transient gap?
The key thing is when you start off with the system, so the sort of measurements predict that both should be affected. But you start off with a situation where only one is at the membrane. So the other one is diffusing too fast. It doesn't sort of feel the flow until it actually starts to load. But once it starts to load, you actually can see this a bit in the model. It gets pushed towards the front, right? So you load, it actually speeds expansion of the domain. So if you inhibit actin during the process of polarity, the domain doesn't expand as far or as fast.
This perhaps is related to Stas's question, but I think the flow would tend to break DV symmetry too. You wouldn't have a donut. You really have sort of this.
Okay.
I mean,
that might explain the fact, but generally, when you look at the 2D plane,
right.
One side is usually stronger than flow on the other. So maybe there is a potential DV break, but it's not DV because essentially it doesn't matter. DV asymmetry is determined by the next cell division. Right, so it could be that there's a potential for a second symmetry breaking cue. So you guys are probably right, but it's not. I don't think it's used by the embryo.
Is it possible to break the symmetry without advection if you have noise in your diffusion?
So we think that you can't break it just with noise. So if you ablate the centrosome with a laser, the system doesn't polarize. There is a second cue. There's a redundant cue that also comes from the centrosome that seems to be microtubule dependent. So you can have sort of a localized microtubule focus coming from the centrosome. And the idea is that that somehow protects the posterior proteins locally, allows them to load. And once they load, they can then start to drive and exclude the anterior proteins from that domain. So essentially, there's these two. There's this flow-based mechanism, which you see in basically wild-type embryos. If you compromise that system, you have this alternative system that can kick in and rescue and form a sort of a domain, although the polarization is much slower when you don't use the effective cue.
So I just forget, did you say that PAR 6 has a slower recovery after FRAP compared to the other one, which was PAR 2?
PAR 2 is actually a little bit slower.
I thought you said.
But they're quite similar.
What you're doing here is that you measured the flow and you plugged it in
yes.
to the reaction diffusion,
yes.
Advection reaction diffusion system. But one could presumably think that the power proteins also control contractility locally, and so therefore the flow itself.
And
have you looked at that?
So we haven't. So since I sort of moved, my lab has moved away from thinking about flows. But in fact, this project was done with Stefan Grill when I was in Dresden, and he's been actively kind of looking at that, because we know that if you make mutants in PAR, the PAR pathway, flows are defective. So the PAR proteins are regulating flow. Whether they're regulating it locally, still not completely clear. Generally, the idea is that the posterior proteins are thought to downregulate flow somewhat, and anterior proteins are required to upregulate it. But no one's really looked at it in really careful detail. Okay. This just says, you know, in the model, you can, if you make flow too dominant, so the system seems to be tuned because if you make flow too dominant, you essentially did the sweeping of the domain across. If you make diffusion too dominant, you can't generate enough of an asymmetry. Right, so this is essentially the idea of the system. You can you have a multi-stable state set up by this reaction diffusion system, and then you can trigger this switch by flows. Maybe in the interest of time. Yeah. You're essentially done. This last bit just gets at two domains of equal size. This gets at this question of dosage. Right, one reason why we think at least one component that helps specify why domains are in the middle is that you have this limiting pool. And what that does is, as you load things onto the membrane, you deplete this pool and essentially you arrest domain growth. So for an example, you have, if you let the system run starting from two different starting points, there is sort of an intrinsic ability to position. If you shift this balance, you get an adjustment in this of this boundary. And as you'd expect, for example, if you look at part two, you see that it's depleted from the cytoplasm exactly when you're loading it onto the membrane. And if you manipulate the sort of dosage, this is sort of the range at which we can change dosage in the system and get viable embryos, you can see that you see changes in the domain size, kind of like what you'd expect for this kind of a model. And in fact, what's striking is I think this is probably the range, the permissive range, because these embryos are quite sick and have lots of sterile worms, and these are quite sick, and these are quite normal.
Another prediction is that it should be also to kill localization.
Yeah, so if we were able to bump this up a bit more.
But if you overexpress only one, it's almost obvious that you will break, I mean, destroy synucleation.
Yes.
But you should be able to destroy it also by simultaneously overexpressing both. Right? Because if you have a limiting cytoplasmic pool and you are not limited for both.
Yes. So the question is whether we could get to that regime where.
Yeah, so whether it's realizable is a separate issue.
Yes. So you actually, I think.
The model you should. See.
Exactly. So you should make both bridges. If you totally overexpress the proteins enough, and actually, one way you could do this is change surface to volume ratios. So that essentially the size of the membrane that you're making, sustaining with a given cytoplasmic pool, becomes smaller and smaller. Again, I don't think we can reach that experimentally. And the alternative is if you reduce the levels of both proteins below a certain threshold to facilitate reactions, you should also lose polarity. But within that range, as long as they're balanced, it works.
Actually, you do get a higher surface to volume ratio as the cells divide and get smaller.
So in fact, it's the opposite of what. So as the cells get smaller, they have a higher surface to volume ratio, so the depletion effect actually gets stronger.
Okay.
And so in fact, as the cell gets smaller, it should be easier to polarize. And we're kind of starting to look in the lab at whether those later cells actually require a symmetry breaking Q, because it's not clear what the Q is for symmetry breaking in those later cells. They polarize spontaneously, but what the Q is, it's not clear. It's not clear that it's the centrosome. Maybe there is a condition where the system moves into the spontaneous polarizing regime. The thing is, we'd have to go on the other side. And there's sort of a limit. We can get embryos that are just ever so slightly bigger, and I was going to talk about it, but I'll just show you one picture to show you kind of the range that we can do. So. I won't talk about this, but essentially, right, so this is the idea, right? So the P lineage, the cell gets smaller and smaller. The model predicts that these get easier to polarize. And then we can use mutants to change the size, but this is essentially the maximum range that we can get. So this is basically about 50 microns, and this goes to about 70. That's kind of the maximum range we can play with. So I think for this pool thing, you have to be out there somewhere. Okay, so in the interest of time, I'm not going to tell you about either of the little vignettes. You guys are free to come and talk to me. Boris said maybe we have another session sometime later. Kind of looking at one of the projects, kind of starting to look at the interplay between cell size and polarization to get at some of these issues, also thinking about these gradient length scales. And Lars, who's the TA for the session we're running in 2 weeks, is sitting right over here. This is his project, so you can also ask him, because he'll know some more of the details than I will. With that, I think I need to wrap up. Let me just thank the people who did the work I didn't show you today. So most of what I showed you was old data, stuff that I did when I was a postdoc in Dresden. This is my lab at the Crick. As I said, Lars is here for the next 3 weeks, so grab him. And then the other project I was going to tell you about gets at trying to sort of tease apart this regulation in a bit more detail. We actually sort of get to the idea that we think there's sort of multiple anterior complexes, and that actually the anterior proteins themselves are regulating different states of that complex. So using some sort of cute tools, drugs, artificial membrane targeting to try to piece this apart, and that's work from Florent, collaboration with Trisana. So maybe we'll get a chance to talk about it with you guys at another point, or one-on-one, or whatever. Thanks.